Okay, so for all those joining us right now on the Zap.Stream, stream, hello. Today we have another amazing guest, Avi Burra. So let's get straight into this. Avi, can you please present yourself to the crowd for those who might not know you?
Hey, Fernando, it's really nice to be here on your show. Enjoyed one of the previous conversations we had a couple of weeks back. But yeah, look, my name is Avi Burra. I'm a author and podcaster in the Bitcoin space. I am been involved in Noster for pretty much since the Jack Dorsey wave began in December of 2022. I launched shortly afterwards a Noster-focused podcast called Plepchain Radio with my co-host Quiet Warrior, who I met on Noster just through shitposting, and we got friendly and just said, "Hey, it seems like we're at the beginning of something, an incredible cultural movement potentially, right? So let's start documenting this in a podcast." So we started that in March of 23. Plepchain Radio typically record as a Noster Nest on Friday evenings, U.S. Eastern time. Sometimes we accommodate, if it's European guests, we do it a little earlier. And yeah, we hit episode 83 just a couple of days back. So once a week. So we've been going for 83 weeks, pretty much nonstop. And then I also wrote the first long-form book of fiction about Bitcoin. It's called 24. I have a copy right here for folks to see. I don't know if you can see that, but
beautiful cover, yes.
Went with the purple and orange as an homage to both Noster and Bitcoin there. So yeah, that book I published, self-published in November of last year. So almost a year back. And it's just it's a fiction story. It's a story of a young man who works at a Web3 shitcoin company. But his father suddenly passes away and he realizes his father's left him a secret. And in the process of unearthing that secret, he understands his relationship with his father better. But at the same time, it's also – so he goes through the five stages of grief because he was very close to his father. But he also goes through simultaneously the five stages of Bitcoin maximalism. So from a shitcoin, a Web3 guy, he becomes a Bitcoin maximalist. So, you know, I wanted to have that type of story. First of all, it's a mystery, right? And so normies or outside people could be attracted by that, and then, you know, try and sly roundabout way, right? Try and orange pill them with the Bitcoin story as well.
The title is 24. Is that correct?
24.
That's right. Is there a reason for that exactly? Or,
well, it's 20. Obviously, when you think about Bitcoin, the number that jumps to most people's mind is 21.
Yes.
But 24 is also a significant number in Bitcoin in a slightly different way. So the book has 24 chapters. Each chapter is one word of his father's secret. And the story is how in each chapter, how he discovers each one of those words. And, you know, it's through some past event in his life. And he's able to access memories from his past and find out the story behind the word.
Yes. Okay. Yeah, it makes sense. Like 24, like seed phrases, 12, 24 words. That makes sense now. Got it now. So like, where can people find this book? Is it on your website, Amazon?
Yeah. It's the easiest way would be just go to Amazon and search for 24, the number 24, right? And Avi Burra, and it'll be the top hit there. That I would say that's the simplest way.
All right, awesome. And how a bit about your backstory? Like, how did you get into Bitcoin, and afterwards into Noster?
Yeah, it's a fairly common. I wish I had a special Bitcoin backstory, Fernando, but it's a fairly common one. Which is, so maybe just taking a step back. I'm an electrical engineer. That's how I started off my career. Working in healthcare robotics, actually, and you're a doctor, Fernando, so maybe you're familiar with this. This is all 20 years back, right? There's a surgical robot called the Da Vinci.
Yeah.
It does minimally invasive surgery. So I was, as I finished grad school for electrical engineering, there was a hospital affiliated to my school, and the research lab was giving out grants for you know, recent graduates with a background in robotics to do some research and some mathematical modeling around the robotic movements to predict surgeon performance and things like that. So that's what I said. I did that for 5 or 6 years. I worked at a cardiothoracic surgery department, the research lab at a major hospital in New York City, but it had nothing to, my work had nothing to do with healthcare, right? It was just number crunching.
Okay.
That was my first foray into healthcare. And then at some point, I was still in my early 20s back then. Then, you know, 5 or 6 years of a cushy research job, right? You know, this basically 3 or 4 publications you need to target in a year. So there's a couple of weeks before each one, you sort of rush to crunch those numbers, make the poster or make whatever, and then you travel to a nice conference. And the rest of the time I was watching soccer at a cafe just walk out, right? It's a research job. Walk out to the closest coffee shop, you know, watch Real Madrid, Chelsea, whatever it is, awesome. Playing. But 5 or 6 years of that in my 20s. And then I met my wife and I said, hey, it's time to get married, time to settle down, time to get a real job that pays real money. So went back to grad school, studied financial engineering, quantitative finance, you know, very related to a lot of the number crunching I was doing, right? Just instead of looking at robotic data, started looking at markets and mostly focused on the fixed income side and got into securitization. And I said, okay, look, I had 6 years in healthcare. This is great. Now I'm switching over to finance. And wouldn't you know it, as I was graduating, one of my professors, the one who taught me securitization, said, hey, I'm launching a startup that's focused on medical receivables, securitizing U.S. Healthcare claims, right? We're building this structured conduit. We need someone who can build a claim valuation engine, build a securitization engine. Would you be interested? So back into healthcare, healthcare fintech. Did that for a while. But now, actually, just taking one quick step back, while I was finishing my financial engineering, this is around early 2011, 2010, late 2010, early 2011, we used to have a message board called QuantNet, where, you know, we just post quant things, questions answered, you know, typical talk forum where you'd get into heated arguments with people about option pricing and Black Scholes and things like that, right? Very silly stuff in retrospect. But some random person posted saying, hey, there's this thing called Bitcoin. It's this new currency. Would anyone be interested in joining me? You know, where I think his proposition was they were going to put some money together, get a bunch of computers, start mining, and, you know, and working on that. And I looked at it and I said, what is this Bitcoin? I don't understand this. It's fine. And I completely dismissed it, as a lot of people do the first time they see it, right?
Yeah.
However, it was a really long thread, really long post from that guy. And there was a lot of back and forth from people that I didn't participate, but I read all of it. And I said, you know, this is a topic I know absolutely nothing about, monetary policy. And I mean, I've studied finance, but what do I know about monetary policy? So I did start looking up, bought some Keynesian book, the most accessible one on Amazon, because yeah. I mean, I didn't know any better back then. And I started, got some background in it, but did, as far as Bitcoin was concerned, did absolutely nothing. So then coming back to this healthcare securitization job, did that for 4 or 5 years. And the company, you know, we made some really good progress, but ultimately that company ran into corporate governance issues and had to flap that up. It was a, you know, 10-person startup. It's kind of unfortunate because I built a lot, wrote a lot of code. We had a lot of meetings with federal regulators on how to structure healthcare receivables and so on. But unfortunately, there was a lot of corporate governance stuff that happened around 2015, 2016, and the company flapped up. So went into independent work for a while. Again, just taking my securitization and helping solar and wind farms restructure their debt using these models. And as I was doing that, someone reached out to me on LinkedIn. So I know I'm giving you a long story, Fernando, but this is where the Bitcoin journey begins.
Go ahead, yeah.
So a guy randomly reached out to me on LinkedIn saying, hey, you have a background in securitization and structured finance. I'm building an exchange traded instrument that's based on cryptocurrencies, and that's going to be trading on, it was either the Bermudan or the Gibraltar Stock Exchange. So one of those really shady ones. It was the Wild West days, right? 2016.
Yeah.
So that's when I said, hey, yeah, I remember this. I remember hearing about Bitcoin. So I went down the crypto rabbit hole at that point. And, you know, started investing in all sorts of crypto nonsense back then. Now, as it turned out, the ICO boom was just beginning, right? So I thought I was a genius. I was making anywhere between 5 to 10% a day.
Wow.
Compounded.
Wow.
Right. And then, yeah, burnt most of it, obviously, on bigger bets, right? You start with a few $100, $1,000, and then it becomes 20, 30,000. And then you're like, oh, I'm a genius. And then you put it in something else and that blows up.
It goes down. Yeah.
It goes down. So, yeah, look, if I keep kicking myself, if I just converted all into Bitcoin back then, I would have been retired by now. But, you know, the number of times I bought Bitcoin, immediately sold it for something else, and just painful
stuff. I have to ask, how did you cope with this? Because there's a lot of people who get burned like this and then immediately go, Bitcoin is bad, Bitcoin is terrible. Like, they get like this type of grudge against crypto in general.
Yeah.
Also Bitcoin. And how did you deal with this?
But first, if you really like the podcast, you can support me by following me on Fountain or on Nostr. You can also follow me on YouTube or on Spotify. And if you really, really like my podcast, you can support me by sending some sats my way. It would be greatly appreciated. Thank you very much.
Yeah, so I'll tell you how I dealt with it. I said, this coin stuff is complete nonsense. But there's something here with the underlying technology, right? Blockchain technology. Maybe there's something there. So what that led me down the blockchain, not Bitcoin way. And I worked in 2017, I started working at a blockchain startup. And we were working with like these big exchanges, stock exchanges that were looking to retool their clearing and settlement infrastructure using blockchain technology. They said, hey, you have a healthcare background. Can you help us build something out for healthcare claims on the blockchain? Right. So did that. And, you know, it was actually, I have to say, really fun job because, you know, these companies were raising at crazy valuations in their Series A, Series B. So we had all this VC capital, and we were traveling around the country, going to conferences, going to client sites, building these little proofs of concepts, you know, having a lot of fun. And in fact, I've actually captured, so this in my book, right? A lot of my journey I've captured in the main character's journey arc as well.
Okay.
I'd like to think I was well-meaning, right? I wasn't an evil guy trying to promote crypto and blockchain. I just didn't know any better. And I was having fun, right? So it was well-intentioned, but ultimately completely misguided sort of stage of my life. And then eventually I reached a stage, Fernando, and maybe this was around 2019, right? So after 2 years of doing this, 2 years of building these proofs of concepts, and having this big press release, you know, then have a big party after the press release. And then the next step comes, which is taking this into production. And every single time, the proofs of concepts were funded by the innovation teams, right? Mm-hmm. Which didn't really have any kind of business mandate. Then we would move to the operations and business side, and they would all kill it because, I mean, this did not scale, right? Or they would say, hey, you know, the transactions per second is too small. The privacy, there's some privacy issues. So our solution to that was centralize everything and you know, fix that. So then what was the point, right? We've just recreated a slow database. So eventually, and I wish this had happened sooner, but it dawned on me in 2019 that this is all just smoke and mirrors. And I remember I was sitting at home one day as I was going through this realization, and I remember asking myself, could it be that the only meaningful use case for a blockchain is peer-to-peer electronic cash, and that the solution already exists? So, you know, it was that kind of, it was, you know, it was that one thought, but there was still a 6 month to 1 year period when I went back and forth, but ultimately I was on the path to Bitcoin maximalism around then. And then by 2020, and then the pandemic hit, and I saw what was happening geopolitically, and I was like, okay, if there was ever a doubt in my mind, it's gone now. I completely see the value of Bitcoin, and Bitcoin only, right? None of this other nonsense, crypto nonsense. So yeah, that's kind of my Bitcoin story. And then, you know, but of course there was a pandemic. 2 years, I locked myself down, not because I was scared of the pandemic, but I was just scared of what the world had become. You know, the people, family members, close friends were turning on each other, and there was so much ugliness. And I said, I don't want to get on a flight. I don't deal with that whole people yelling at me for not wearing a mask. And then this, and pretty soon, I think by early 2021, it's like became show your papers everywhere, right? And by then, I'd left New York City. I moved out like a few hours north into the mountains, into the countryside, because New York City was going completely out of control. People had just completely lost their minds over this thing, and they enacted a mandate, right, for restaurants and most indoor spaces that you had to show your papers to be granted entry. So I didn't want to deal with any of that stuff. So we just locked ourselves down as a family for 2 years, but. Those 2 years were when I did all my reading, my podcast listening, right? I was just in a complete absorb mode. And then finally, early 2022, like spring of 2022, I said, okay, now I'm ready. Now I'm ready to actually start doing something. And I went to Bitcoin Miami, incredible experience. Just meeting all these people I'd been listening to, reading their books, right? I'd read Bitcoin is Venice. I went and had a really nice dinner with Alan Farrington, met Gladstein, met all these other folks. And that was kind of like my, okay, I'm ready to do something. So that around then, the idea for my book was born, but it took me over a year to write it. But then Nostra happened a few months afterwards, right? In December of that year. And that was kind of the fuel for me to really start expressing myself. So yeah, that's kind of my story. I think we talked about the part afterwards, after Nostra, right? Podcast, got the book published, now launching, using my healthcare experience, trying to build something on Nostra with Nosfabrica. So yeah, that brings us to the present, Fernando.
Awesome. Amazing story. I love the details. Like I love a good story. And so there's a few tangents we can take from there. So first of all, I agree with the pandemic opened a lot of people's eyes. It definitely did the same for me. I had a lot of free time. I was in Latvia in Europe during that time. Wow. So over there you had your QR codes on your cell phone. You needed to scan. You had to have your shot first. You get a QR code. And with that QR code, you could like live in society. Otherwise, you'd be restricted a lot. So that let's say this tyrannical or government overreach really gave a lot, started to make you question a lot of things, especially in my case in healthcare, you know, because when they started forcing you to take the jab or you would lose your job or you'd lose certain benefits, that just immediately that was a big red flag for me personally. And I got down the vaccine rabbit hole, I guess, and that brought me down through economics. I guess I also loved history. So learning about history, there's a lot of, some historians who recommend you learn about economics because there's a lot of historians who don't know economics, and it's really good to complement both of things. And he recommended this fantastic book. It's Economics and One Lesson by Henry Hazlitt. That only opened my eyes even more to how inefficient government is. So that was pretty, it's like rabbit hole after rabbit hole after rabbit hole. And I think it's a similar journey, just like you shared, like you just start seeing the inefficiencies, the problems. And it's this curiosity to see, how can I fix this? What can I do to improve this? And you mentioned you've been in healthcare. That was like since when you graduated from your engineering, right? From electrical engineering?
That's right. Again?
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Why exactly healthcare though? Like, was that something you were always looking into in the beginning? Or you just ended up in healthcare?
It just happened. It just happened, Fernando. I mean, I was, you know, there's... I'm kind of very late stage Gen X, right? I'm the youngest of the Gen X, maybe on the border of Gen X and millennial, right? But I sort of identify more with the Gen X sort of mindset, which unfortunately I don't think is a particularly, it can be healthy because it's almost like a apathetic, stoic kind of attitude towards life, right? You don't get swayed too much one way or the other. But with that apathy, I think there is a risk of sliding into cynicism and then ultimately nihilism, right? So, and I faced this in my early 20s a lot. And for me, it was like, what is the point of everything? All I know is I want to be happy. So I'm just going to, you know, have fun, right? It's like, what, there is no meaning or purpose to this universe, but that's okay. I'm in this body. Let me just have a good time, right? So the reason I'm telling you this is that kind of seeped into my, career aspirations as well, which is like, hey, let me just find something that's, you know, where I can watch football, soccer, right? That's what I want to do. I want to drink wine. I want to have good coffee. I want to watch football, eat good food. I just need enough money that this stuff gets taken care of. You know, 22, 23-year-old. Want to watch good movies. That's always time to do that, right? So when this job opportunity came up right out of college, I was like, yeah, it's a research job, sounds pretty easy. It's at a hospital, right? And I live, you know, 10 blocks away on the Upper West Side of Manhattan. I can walk there. Great, I'll take it. And then every other job I've had was all before going into it, right? Before I knew I was going to take that job. But I knew I was leaving the previous job. I said, okay, I'm done with healthcare. Now it's time for something else. And it always came back to healthcare somehow or another. So now I've just embraced it. I said, you know what? Maybe this is what I was meant to do. So life keeps taking me down this path. Let me just double down and triple down and make it happen.
Yeah, and I think that's fantastic because, yes, there are huge problems with healthcare. And that leads me to the next question. What problems have you seen in healthcare, like ever since you began and up to now? And what, like, does Bitcoin and is Bitcoin and Nostr the tools to fix it, to improve it? Or were there tools in the past that simply weren't being used effectively because of, let's say, government regulation?
Yeah, I can talk primarily about U.S. healthcare, but I think broadly some of these concepts apply world over, right, to global healthcare as well. But I'm not involved in care delivery, right? I'm not a clinician, you know, I'm a technologist, but so I've seen the revenue cycle side, the money movement side, the data movement side of healthcare, and the business side. So in the US, and at every stage, I've worked on different ways of trying to fix this problem, right? With the healthcare securitization startup I was working in, right? Why were we trying to securitize healthcare claims? It's so that the business problem we were solving was twofold. One, primarily, hospitals or doctors don't get paid on time, right? It's a three-sided market in the US. You have a hospital or doctor, you have a patient, and you have an insurance company, right? And the patient has an insurance policy. So what happens is, insurance company has what is known as a network of providers, right? A network meaning they tell the patient, if you buy our policy, here are all the doctors who have agreed to our terms, right? Our rates for procedures and so on. So you'd go to a hospital, which is in-network typically, or doctor or clinic, whatever it is, right? You'd get the care. They tell you, here's your co-payment, $20, right, for this. And then what they do is they write this up as a claim, right? Whatever they've done, they put the procedure codes, the diagnosis codes. There's ostensible data standards that govern that today. And then they send that to an insurance company. And then the insurance company, they quote unquote adjudicate that claim, see if it's medically necessary, see if the patient actually had coverage for those, all of that stuff, and then they pay it. Sounds nice on the surface, but here's the problem. What is an insurance company's business model? They're collecting premiums from patients, right? So that's their revenue stream. And anything they pay out is a loss. A claim is a loss. So they're trying to maximize their profits and minimize their losses, right? That's straight up incentive. Now, in the US, there is a statutory regulation that says insurance companies have to pay out, you know, something like 70% of all the premiums they've taken in, right? It's called the MLR, medical loss ratio. So only 30%, maximum 30% they can keep as profit. If they don't pay out 70%, they have to rebate that back pro rata, right? To evenly distribute it to all the patients, all the members of the policy. But how do they game this? they take the premiums and they park it in short-term treasuries and collect the float on this. So that's additional revenue for them, right? And so then the incentive becomes, yes, I know we have to pay the claim because of at least 70% of the premiums we're sitting on, but we can delay it. Because as the longer we delay it, the more float we can collect, right? The more yield we collect on this cash we've parked in treasury. So meanwhile, the hospital they have a liquidity issue, right? They have to pay their staff, but they need the money to come in for this. So it's completely misaligned incentives. And what the hospital then does is they start jacking up their rates because they know their claims will be delayed and denied. So they try and game it by upcoding their procedures and what have you, right? So it's just there's a constant battle here. And ultimately, it's the patient, the center, who should be the most important person in this equation, who gets shafted. Because what happens is when the insurance company denies a claim, which could happen like a month after the procedure was done, by the way, right? Then the hospital billing system looks at it and tries to reconcile and then say, okay, you know what? We're going to go back to the patient and hit them with the bill. So 2 months after you've had your X-ray or whatever, you get a, and you pay, you thought you had a $20 copayment and that's it. You get a bill for $1,000 for your payments. So this is as a result, there's a lot of medical debt, and the system gets abused. A lot of people just end up going to the emergency room for basic care in the US and then end up just taking, because if you go to the emergency room, you cannot be denied care. And then you just don't pay the bill, right? Because you can't afford the bill. So because of this, premiums go up and then the healthcare providers try to game the system more. And then it's just a vicious downward cycle. So yeah, these were some of the issues I saw. So again, I guess I started talking about my first company, right? Why were we securitizing healthcare claims and trying to come up with the valuation of them so that we could give loans to the healthcare providers to deal with this liquidity issue that they face, right? For 3 weeks or so. So we would advance the funds to them at a small interest rate. And then when the insurance payments came in, we would make the, you know, amortize the loan that way. So that was one attempt to fix this. And then with blockchain, when I went into the blockchain stuff, it was, can we use smart contracts to reverse engineer this adjudication process, right, that insurance companies have? Short answer is no, you cannot do that. But we tried doing that for a while, straight through processing of claims. So that again, the before the patient leaves the office, the doctor knows, okay, I'm going to get $100 for this extra from the insurance company and $20 from the patient. So let me just charge it and close the encounter then and there. So it was, you know, repeated attempts to solve this problem using the tools that created the problem in the first place, right? So I think what the other part of your question is, can Bitcoin and Nostr fix this? I think absolutely yes. And this is a healthcare to US healthcare especially, but also world over, is a perfect example where you need the Nostr solution first before the Bitcoin solution comes in and solves the big problem of fiat incentives. And the reason you need a Nostr solution is the data layer is completely broken in healthcare because of this three-stakeholder equation that we have, a three-sided market. There are multiple fragmented, siloed systems. You have middlemen coming in, introducing cost and bureaucracy, administrators, you know, clearing houses, all of that, right? And you lots of data silos, lots of systems that don't talk to each other properly, and there's reconciliation, human error gets introduced. So if you can solve that with Nostr, which I absolutely believe you can, by having a clean data standard, give both patients and doctors full control and ownership over their key data. Once you solve that data problem, then the payments follows easily, right? Especially if you're doing it on Nostr, then you just introduce that Lightning payments layer.
Yeah, I talked about that with Vito Pamplona in the previous podcast. He actually goes into how Nostr can help solve healthcare, which is amazing and heavily, heavily needed. So that's where Nostr comes in to help fix the database, basically. But how would Bitcoin, in your opinion, also help fix healthcare?
Well, I mean, there's a lot of friction today and middlemen, right, in the payments landscape as well. There's the originating bank, there's the point of sale processing company, there's the hospital's bank, there's the insurance company's bank, each of them taking a little bit of their cut in the flow of funds. And, you know, the settlement is not instantaneous, right? It's no one's using Fed now for the so-called real-time payments layer that the Fed has just rolled out. No one's using that. Everyone uses the legacy system. So with Bitcoin, you just make it peer-to-peer payments, right? No, you cut out all the middlemen. You just pay the whatever the Lightning transaction fee is, which is de minimis here, and it's sovereign, right? It's like it comes from let's say you get rid of the insurance company or make them not a factor in all of this. It's just a peer-to-peer encounter. You convert a three-sided market into a true two-sided market, like a retail market, right? You have the consumer of the service, the patient, and you have the provider of the service, the doctor. They interact cash equivalent settlement, right? It's a better instrument settlement then and there. You take out a lot of the waste, a lot of the cost. You close the encounter then and there.
And even in the healthcare industry in a way, for a long time. And do you see that there's a demand for solutions like this, like Nostr-based solutions? How do you think they would take in this type of information, these offerings?
Well, so there, if you ask any of the healthcare providers or patients, like, hey, do you want a Bitcoin or Nostr-based solution? Do you have a need for that? They'll say, no, absolutely not. Well, first of all, what is Nostr? Secondly, isn't Bitcoin used by terrorists and criminals? So I don't think they'll. If you ask the average doctor or the patient that specific question, you wouldn't get that answer, right? But what they will tell you is, here are all my pain points, right? If I need to change doctors, I have to beg my previous doctor for my health records. I might not get them in their entirety. I might not get them in a format that my new doctor is going to be able to process or accept or analyze in any meaningful way, right? So they'll spell pain points out at that level from a pure user experience standpoint. And then, you know, yeah, they'll just say, why does it cost so much, right? Why do I not know if I want an X-ray? Why don't I know the cost of an X-ray, right? They tell me co-payment is 20, and then why do I get a bill for $300? So they'll start listing out all of these pain points. And then from the doctor side, there's a whole laundry list as well, right? We have to have all of these administrators who need to be on the phone with insurance companies saying, why did you deny my claim? You know, paying them $30, $40 an hour. I need to have people coding up claim in this very specific format that insurance companies can understand. If I make a small mistake, they reject the claim, right? So it's an obscene amount of administrative waste from a provider standpoint. So they'll articulate the problem at that level. And I think it's up to folks like us to say, yes, I will solve that problem for you. I will make this user experience completely seamless, right? You can fire all your administrators, help them find a better future for themselves, a more constructive future for themselves, right? And just make it completely sovereign, peer-to-peer interactions where you can close your transaction as soon as the patient walks out of your office, both from a doctor and a patient standpoint, right? And if they say, how are you going to do that? That's when you say, well, yeah, we're actually using these tools, and then you can go into the explanation. But from their standpoint, it's problems, multiple pain points, a lot of waste. And if you can build that incredible user experience using Nostr and Bitcoin, which I absolutely believe you can, I think that's what they want to hear.
Yeah, like you mentioning that, what comes to mind is you can deliver the message in a sly around way. Like, I forgot what the saying is in English, but basically you don't talk about Nostr. You just give them the client, the app, and what it does. You know, yeah. they don't care if it's about Nostr. But on the Bitcoin side, I think Strike, for example, you use dollars, but uses the Lightning Network to transmit these dollars, the USDT or whatever, depending where you are. So like it's just basically creating this parallel system and then just making them hop on it, see that it works without them really having to understand what's the underlying let's see, what do you call it in programming, the back end. They don't have to understand the back end. They have to see the front end, the UI, which is pretty cool. So I know you're working on a project right now. What you're mentioning right now is your current project. I don't know if you want to mention any details or things about it.
Yeah, happy to talk a little bit about that. It's still early days, right? So I've got together with two other folks, and we're launching this company called Nos Fabrica, which in Latin means our factory, right? And then it's also, there's Nos, so it's a nice little hat tip to Noster as well. And the idea is to fix, first and foremost, that data layer, right? So create that gold standard of data availability, both for patients and for providers, so that they can have these seamless interactions. Now, a perfect example of this would be something like a marketplace, right? A patient has some symptoms, and they don't know what it is. They need to find the care. So they go to a portal, sign in with Noster, right? With some kind of browser extension, right? Maybe we'll make that process even simpler so that it's very familiar for them, right? But they sign in a way they used to, and then they type in their symptoms into a box, says my arm is hurting. And then, you know, there's some kind of intelligent search that says, maybe you need to see a radiologist, right? So here are a list of radiologists in your area, and it has the reviews of every single one of them. And then you say, well, you know, what are the, every single one of these guys has a 5-star review. Oh, by the way, and they have their prices listed for x-rays, right? Which does not, especially in the US, does not exist today, right? So you look at the prices, you look at the ratings, and then you have the option of filtering those ratings by your web of trust, right? Because those ratings can be gamed by bots, right? Everyone has a 5-star rating. You click a checkbox that says, only show me the ratings given by my trusted circle of people. And then it filters that down, and suddenly the 5-star rating becomes a 4.3, right? So then you look at the one that kind of has a good rating and a good price. You schedule an appointment. You can pay then and there on Lightning if you want, or wait until you've actually had the appointment to do it. So this sort of care discovery marketplace with radical price transparency, right? And it's a peer-to-peer interaction between a patient and a doctor. That's one example of the type of application we're looking to build. But really, the reason we called it a factory is a clean data layer enables so much more than so many more applications for different use cases that can be built, right? Like you could have an individual medical record client for a patient where they have the full list of all of their medical history, right? And then they can selectively disclose that when they go to their different providers, right? You can have a provider-facing app that allows them to manage their board certifications and their credentials. This is a big issue in the U.S. If you're a doctor, practicing doctor in New York, and you move to Texas, you move to a hospital in Texas, that hospital is paying you money, but you can't see any patients until your board certification and all your other credentials have transferred from New York to Texas, and that could take months, right? If the doctor had full sovereignty over their data, it would be a simple transfer and you know, run a quick validation and done. That's it. So you know, you can have so many applications here that are powered by Noster where the users don't need to know it's Noster, right? All they know is they have this incredible user experience that solved problems that they had no idea could be solved in the legacy system.
Interesting. I didn't know that part about the data validation in the United States. Like when you change from state, you have to get what, board certified again, or they have to check your credentials, right? For you to work again,
update them.
Okay. And in Mexico, like you get a federal like number, like cédula professional working number, and you can work in any state. So different states might have different. You might need to also get a special credential to work legally there, but usually with your federal number, you can work there. So it's interesting how like Noster can adapt to different countries and different places. I'm guessing the initial country of focus will be the United States in Nos Fabrica. More or less, or you're still...
No, you know, the U.S. is the lowest hanging fruit. Well, there's two sides to it, right? It has the most problems, I think, is the most fiat of all the healthcare systems out there. So that's where the opportunity lies. Now, also because of that, with that comes the complexity and the regulations and so on. So there's the balance between challenge and opportunity there. But there's also, we've been talking to physicians in Europe as well, right? So we're open to exploring different parts of the world. We're talking to folks in Latin America, Europe. I think wherever the use case presents itself, we're happy to work there.
I'm curious. Have you spoken with, I forgot the name of the company, BitHealth. I know it's in the United States, and they help people get, it's not health insurance, but it acts like that in a way. Do you remember the name? Crowd Health. Yes, Crowd Health. Have you talked with these people? I wonder if they have shown any interest in this Noster solution.
Not yet. Again, Fernando, it's early days for us, right? We've just launched the company and working through some of those details. Crowd Health is an example of a use case that's incredibly complementary to what we're building, right? Because if again, take that care discovery marketplace example, right? The patient is searching for care, they find the care they need, they find the right based on reviews and so on, and then they can pay, and that can just pull directly from their, if there's some kind of integration into Crowd Health, right? It could go to, that payment request can go to Crowd Health and be paid there that way. So I think it's a potentially very complementary. We haven't talked to them yet. I suspect we will reach out over the next month or so and start those conversations.
Cool. It's slowly accelerating. I would love to get together with you again in the future once you launch officially, to get the word out. And I personally would love to help in whatever way. If you ever think of expanding into Mexico, it's a very. I know that health tourism is very common here in Mexico. Like a lot of people from the United States come over here, so that can be very complimentary. I can imagine like having your doctor's data from the USA just coming to Mexico, and you still got all the information. Your doctor can access it if you want it. That would be so awesome. Now I have to. Well, this is also a carnivore podcast, so I have to ask: have you ever tried a low carb diet or a carnivore based diet?
I have, and it's worked. I've done keto. I've done carnivore for a shorter period, and I've done a high protein. So you know, keto is like high fat, medium protein, low carb. So I flipped the protein and fat. That one is the one that's worked best for me, I would say. And it, you know, it's mostly meat based, but I add things like yogurt and cheese and stuff like that, right? Just to keep the taste profile little broader. So I don't know if eggs are considered carnivore, but I certainly have.
Yeah, on a carnivore diet.
So,
I'm sorry. Continue. I was going to ask any of this because of any health reasons or just because everyone was talking about it in the Bitcoin space and you decided to try it out.
We're not seeing each other in person, right? One of my advantages is just because of my frame and my build, the weight doesn't always show on me. But you know, I know the truth, and I've constantly grappled with so I'm 6'1", right? So I should be around 180 pounds ish. Do you understand pounds, Fernando? Or
it's like kilo, I got like 90 kilos. Yeah, like around 90 kilos.
A little low. 84, 85 kilos. Okay. I think it's a little less. Or 80, yeah. Right? So that's what works really well for me, and I keep going. Over the last 15-20 years, it's like 1 year I'm, you know, about 20% above, come, you know, then try something, get myself back down, you know. So I don't look fat necessarily, but it's there. So long way of saying, I've tried these diets in the up cycles where I'm like, oh my God, okay, I need to do something now to get it back down to 180. And, you know, keto's worked. Carnivore was a tough one for me because I went pure carnivore. I did that for a few weeks. And I was like, I'm just I'm not getting enough of a taste profile. Like I cut out wine. I cut everything out in that diet. So that was a slightly tough one for me. So then I went back to this mostly meat-based, but high protein, medium fat, and the low carb diet. I think that's worked the best, and that's what I need to get back on because I'm back at the high end of the weight again.
Again, so like you'd get off of it and go back to like, what was your traditional or basic diet like then? Like typical standard American diet?
These days? Yeah. These days it's pretty so the last 6 months I've been pretty indisciplined about my diet. So I would say, yeah, you know, maybe pizza once or twice a week. Definitely have pizza, burgers. And then when we cook at home, we cook healthy. Right, you know, steak or
do you use vegetable oil? Vegetable oils?
No.
Perfect. Yeah, that's important.
Yeah.
Although you do find a lot of that in restaurant food, but
that's
when you would transition to like, well, try out keto or carnivore. How was how were your cognitive abilities? Did you feel more alert? Did you feel more drowsy? Headaches? Like, were there any improvements? What were the drawbacks?
So one of the things I did when I was on keto was I coupled that with intermittent fasting. So it's the 16-8. When I was in full ketosis, oh man, cognitive abilities were through the, I felt energized, but again, the problem for me is it's not sustainable just from a lifestyle standpoint because I like good food, and it's like I can't. This is getting too. I can't have coconut oil with my coffee. I can't, you know, or whatever it is you do to keep yourself in ketosis, right? I'm not able to eat ribeye steak every single day. I need something a little different, right? So the sustainability of the diets. Yeah. I completely see the benefits. It's just the sustainability is tough for me.
Yeah, usually it is one of the major factors initially, although your body does get used to it. Like I still get like this these cravings for certain sweets. If I'm walking down the aisle with sweet bread, like it's an addiction type of thing. Like sugar is literally a drug. So basically what I do with patients is initially I tell them transition slowly. Like because changing diets is a stressful thing for the body. At least throughout 6 weeks, you slowly start to transition to a carnivore diet. And then when you get these cravings and things like that, it's just a matter of, well, psychology, of course, but simply eating more meat. And for taste things, like, you know, there's a lot of versions of keto. You got eggs, you got dairy, if you can tolerate it. Mm-hmm. You got multiple vegetables and some fruits you can take as well that are still considered keto or ketovore-ish like. But the reason I personally like to follow a carnivore diet is because I'm a simple guy. I like to just eat steak, eat until I'm full, not counting calories, not worrying about anything. And then I don't have to worry about my weight or health or whatever later on. And I eat once or twice a day when I've been a carnivore for 20 months now. So I love just having to eat once or twice a day, not having to waste time preparing food, washing dishes and things like that. Nice and simple. And I like the productivity boost. Overall, that's what I love the most. Because when I was following my standard Mexican diet, I'd feel drowsy in the afternoons, you know, after eating a lot of tortas and tamales and all these rich in carbs, you know, you get this sugar goes down after your insulin spike and you just feel drowsy and unproductive. And now I just can keep on going all day. And I love that. And I think, that's a very cool thing amongst Bitcoiners. Everyone's heard of the carnivore diet, I think, eventually, once you get the Bitcoin, everyone's going to hear that. Seyfried Namus himself is a carnivore. He's known very well. So, and I think Bitcoin makes you more productive because, you know, you save your purchasing power increases and you can accumulate more capital and invest in other things. I think carnivore gives you this health back. It doesn't have to be carnivore, just low carb, non-processed.
Fernando, could I ask you a question about the carnivore? Because I've certainly experienced the short-term benefits of it, right? The cognitive boost, you don't get the carb coma and all of that stuff.
Yeah.
What do you... is there any research out there, not fiat research, like real research, right? Actual scientific method research out there on the long-term, potential long-term implications of a carnivore diet? Because I've heard some pushback from folks on gut health, right? There's not enough fiber and stuff like that. So what are your thoughts on that?
Well, first of all, there is no research. And there's no research on any diet long-term. And usually it's observational crappy fiat studies. Like there are, it'd be very cool to get some Bitcoin studies out there, but anyways, they don't exist. So You can't base your health or what you should eat based on nutritional science and its current state. You probably never will, the way it's the way the science is. But in terms of the fiber, like, we do not know anything about the microbiome. There was this this American study done for 10 years from 2006 to 2017, I believe. No, 2016. 10 years studying the microbiome, the American microbiome experiment. And they were just, they spent $1 billion in these 10 years studying the microbiome. And they just discovered that they don't know what's the optimal microbiome. That was the objective. And then they just found out there's more questions to answer now. And the microbiome can change dramatically. In just 48 hours, if you change your diet, your microbiome is completely different. And you can have completely healthy people with completely different microbiomes. So for those people who say, this is the optimal microbiome, they're full of it. No, we do not know what's the correct answer. And it's going to change it depending on your environment. You know, if you're like, you're raised in Africa, for example, and you're like the Maasai, you're exposed to the feces of the animals, and you drink the water from the pond and things like that, your microbiome will change dramatically. But generally, it's been agreed upon that more diversity is supposedly better. You can't conclude that, but apparently that's what the associations show. And on the carnivore diet, it's been mixed results. Like, there's some studies where you have a huge biodiversity, even larger than when you're on eating a lot of fiber. And others where you say, look, it's a low diversity and it could be a problem. But long-term studies, no, there's no properly done studies that evaluate long-term health implications. All we have is anecdotal evidence. So there's like this woman, I think the longest, she's like 87 years old. She's been following a carnivore diet since she was a child. Like, she's a rancher. So it's just meat every day. Dr. Anthony Chafee has interviewed her and everything. Zero health problems, you know, but again, it's just N equals one there. So you can't extrapolate the information there. But there's a lot of carnivores who've been doing this for decades with no nutritional deficiencies. But I wouldn't worry about it. If you look at it from an anthropological perspective, humans have been eating meat for hundreds, a thousand years. If you've taken Homo sapiens, yeah, sapiens into account, if you take into consideration our ancestors, you know, Homo habilis, Homo erectus, 4.5 million years. So we're more than adapted for meat.
And the question there is, and that makes sense to me, right? That this is our, and maybe some wild berries or whatever they found, able to forage and stuff like that. But there, they didn't have a consistent feeding schedule, right? If they killed a beast, they would feast on it for whatever, like a week or however long it lasted, right, within the tribe. And then presumably they went a few weeks starving or with very little food, right? So they weren't eating meat every single... Is that how you understand it, Fernando? That, you know, it wasn't like the consistent meals that we have today.
Yeah, there'll be moments of fasting, involuntary fasting amongst our... Humans are designed for fasting, actually. We can produce more ketones than other carnivore animals. So it's like a unique adaptation we pretty much have. We can turn fat into ketones, and that helps power us quite efficiently. And yeah, in the terms of berries, yeah, we'd have berries whenever we could, right? But let's remember, it was an ice age when Homo sapiens was developing. Mm-hmm. So there weren't fruits and vegetables growing 24/7 all year long. It'd just be a tiny window during the year where we could like feast on some random berries here and there. Plus, the fruits and the vegetables and fruits that exist nowadays did not exist hundreds, even less, thousands of years ago. Humans have selectively bred these huge number of plants we eat now. Back then, we would eat mainly tubers. And you can know this because you would do a stable isotope analysis of nitrogen and carbon. And you could see more or less what the diet was, and was predominantly meat. With the plants we would eat, mainly being tubers, you know, big fibrous tubers, like not like the potato, which is full of starch nowadays. So yeah, fasting also very common. And that's why a lot of people see a lot of health benefits with fasting as well, because autophagy and things like that. But nowadays, Americans think they have to eat 5-6 times a day, and that's considered healthy. All the contrary. If you would ever want to read, because I think the Bitcoin space and the Ostrich space is amazing, because we're taking it's a battle of ideas, you know, because there's all types of people on Ostrich. You got socialists, you got your vegans. Yeah, it's not the predominantly one group or the other. And it's a fantastic battle of ideas. There's no censorship on Nostr. And with Bitcoin, you can put your money where your mouth is. You can like support the ranching industry if you want, buying meat with your Bitcoin, because there's Bitcoiner ranchers on Nostr as well. I think time will simply show who is what is the optimal thing. Let the market decide, basically. So we'll see how the vegan carnivores are versus the the Bitcoin vegans versus the Bitcoin carnivores and things like that. I am against, though, the dogmatic approach to a carnivore diet. Those who say you have to eat this way and this is the only way, and if you include cheese or whatever, like, you're not a carnivore. I don't think that's the way. I think everyone has to experiment. I do think the optimal diet is the closest to 100% carnivore as possible. Meat-based, red meat, mainly red meat. But that's up to everyone to decide, obviously. And if you ever feel interested in trying this out, I'd be more than happy to help you out. Try it for 3 months. It'd be pretty interesting thing to do. And we're almost out of time. Avi, do you have anything you'd like to add? Share with
No, I enjoyed this chat, Fernando. Looking for, maybe we'll with Nos Fabrica, we can collaborate there. So looking forward to that. I might reach out to you on the carnivore thing because I'm at the upper end, as I was saying, of my weight again. So I need to do something to reset, get back to a healthy weight. If you're listening, you want to read a book of Bitcoin fiction, pick up 24, go to Amazon.com, 24 Avi Bura. This is what the book looks like. Let me see if I can get it in front of the camera. There it is.
There you go. Yes.
And listen to Plepchain Radio every Friday on Nosterness and out on Fountain the day after.
You mentioned Nosterness. So that means anyone who's interested can just drop in live during the podcast, right?
Yes, we announce the time a few days in advance. Usually it's in the evenings, U.S. Eastern time, around 6 p.m., but sometimes earlier. But they can draw, you can sign in using Albi, sign in with Nostr using Albi, and then you can drop in and listen in on the Nest.
Perfect. Like for those, I'm going to upload this video to YouTube later on. So for those who don't know what Nostr Nest is, it's basically like Twitter Spaces. So you can hear, you can even interact with the hosts and those who are speaking. I think we need a nice, there has to be a nice, what's the great best video that you would recommend to normies who want to find out what Nostr is, how to use it, because it can be pretty complex.
Yeah, I think for a general introduction, broad introduction to what Nostr is, right? There's a guy called, I don't know if you know him, Fernando, Max DeMarco. He's a filmmaker.
Yes.
And so he made a Nostr movie. It was almost a year ago, actually over a year ago now. So that movie is a good introduction to, like, at a high level, what Nostr is. So if no one knows what Nostr is, they should go to YouTube, type in Max DeMarco, Max DeMarco, Nostr, and it'll show up. Technical resources or videos, new stuff is getting built practically on a daily basis, so it's hard to keep up. But there's Nostr.how. It's not a video, but it's a list of resources that people can look at and to start using Nostr.
Yeah, actually, I think you can also just ask a Nostr. You put the hashtag Ask Nostr or Askter.
Yeah.
People are more than willing to help. So we hope everyone gets motivated, tries out Nostr. I'll leave every thing that Avi just mentioned in the description below, links to his book, his podcast, and to the episode, to the YouTube video or video that Max DeMarco made, so you guys can understand that. Anyways, Avi Bura, thank you very much. I can't wait to have you back on the show once you launch Nos Fabrica. I think it's going to be, I think you'll have a first mover advantage because that's something everyone is looking for. And it's gonna add a lot of value to people's lives. So thank you again, Avi, for coming on.
Yeah, thank you for having me, Fernando.